The Life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca, Podcast 3, The Crisis of AD 19. Welcome back to this podcast series on the life of Lucius Annaeus Seneca. So far, we've seen him leave his birth city of Cordoba in Spain while still an infant and travel to Rome in the arms of his aunt, so that his education could be guided by his father, Seneca the Elder. He has undergone the standard education of an upper-class Roman boy, firstly at the hands of an educated slave, then under a grammaticus, and finally, up until around the age of 16, he has, along with his classmates, been subjected to a rigorous grounding in the arts of forensic thinking and oratory under a rhetor. A Roman boy's entire education at this time was to prepare him for a career in public office. Seneca's actual year of birth is difficult to nail down. Anywhere between 8 to 1 BC has been suggested. My own estimate, based on later events that we can pin down, is that it would have been nearer the end of that range. So, we left Seneca at age 16, having just completed his training under the rhetor. At this point, many wealthy Roman boys were sent overseas, mostly to Greece or the Greek islands, to undertake further training and hone their oratorical skills under a prestigious teacher of the art. Much as Cicero and Julius Caesar had done with Apollonius of Rhodes a few generations before. But there's absolutely no evidence at all that Seneca did this. He does, however, in his later writings, give us some indication of how he was spending his time in the Rome of around this first two decades of the Christian era. So let's skip a couple of years and find out what Seneca has been up to. The year is AD 19, and Seneca is in big trouble with his father. The mighty Augustus, first true emperor of the Julio-Claudian line, had died 5 years previously in AD 14. Having no natural successor, Augustus had eventually adopted his stepson, Tiberius, and it was that stony-faced and taciturn politician, more soldier than statesman, who had, rather reluctantly by many accounts, taken over the reins of power. After a slow but solid start, Tiberius was beginning to stamp his authority on Rome and the empire as a whole. As part of a general tidy-up of morals and an assertion that the superiority of traditional Roman customs and religious practices, Tiberius abolished what he considered to be foreign cults in Rome. Egyptian and Jewish sects were hit especially hard, probably because they were the most numerous. All adherents to these so-called cults were forced to burn anything, that's robes, vestments, religious props, that they used for worship. The Jews seem to have been persecuted more than most. It would appear there was also a national security strategy behind Tiberius's decree in AD 19, as Jewish men of military age were drafted into the Roman army and then posted to areas with unhealthy climates, presumably to deplete their numbers. All other Jews, along with anybody else clinging to similar outlandish beliefs, were evicted from the city and threatened with slavery if they refused to comply. So why did Seneca find himself in hot water at this time? To answer that, we have to take a quick look at the Roman attitude to philosophy. The so-called schools of Greek philosophical thought had been creeping into Roman society for some time before the ultimate annexation of the Greek mainland in 146 BC. In 155 BC, for instance, Athens, as part of its negotiations with the Roman Senate at the time, had sent a delegation of three philosophers. One was Stoic, one was Peripatetic, and one was Academic. in order for the Greek city to put its case. Now, it would be fair to state that the Romans were, first and foremost, a practical folk. They liked solutions, something that Greek philosophy, with all its fancy theory and clever word tricks, was in short supply of. On the other hand, as I've mentioned in a previous podcast, many things Greek, including the Greek language, held incredible snob value for the Romans. And so philosophy did take root in Rome, but it appears to have been on Roman terms. The Romans seemed to be relatively okay on a kind of, yep, there's something in that attitude towards the academics who more or less started with Plato, but there's strong evidence to suggest that the dry empiricism of the Peripatetics, a school founded by Aristotle, was not at all to Roman taste. Despite our modern perception of Aristotle and some others as the be-all and end-all of much Western thought, something the rediscovery and redistribution of many works during the European Renaissance is largely responsible for, it would appear that Seneca, who was much nearer the source than we are today, considered Aristotle and many of his ilk as pedantic little nitpickers. There were, of course, some fundamental philosophical differences involved here, but a large part of Seneca's distaste sprang from the fact that Romans of his time preferred slamming home their points with punchy, colourful rhetoric and offering solutions to everyday problems with practical advice in easy-to-understand terms, rather than droning on and on about philosophical theory and dreary, impenetrable jargon. Then, of course, there was the Epicurean school, founded by Epicurus himself. It did find favour with the 1st century BC Roman poet Lucretius, but by Seneca's time, the Romans had twisted Epicurus's basic message, which was pleasure's fine, but in moderation, to their own take on it, which was let's all have a bloody good time and immerse our senses in licentious delight. It was Stoicism, though, that struck the loudest chord with the Roman psyche. This philosophy was all about personal responsibility and taking it on the chin. Stoics believed that the universe unfolded to a predetermined plan that was inflexible and inevitable. Their version of God was beyond the power of humans to entreat. Because you couldn't do anything about what was going to happen to you, either good or bad, the best policy, the Stoics said, was to shrug your shoulders and get on with life. It wasn't what happened to you that was important, they said, but how you reacted to it. Now, the Romans knew all about that attitude. Their history books were full of heroes, many probably mythical, who, aware of the mores maiorum, or the customs of the ancestors, had undergone incredible hardship, pain even, in order to achieve something for the common good. Gaius Mucius Scaevola was one such, a youth who, during the early Republic, having been caught on a mission to assassinate the Etruscan king, Lars Porsena, who was, at the time, besieging Rome, stuck his right hand into a fire and held it there, displaying no pain whatsoever. The purpose of this, it would appear, was to demonstrate how hard the Romans were, so that Porsena would be deterred from messing with them. This is the kind of attitude the Romans admired. And that is why Stoicism's take one for the team approach to life appealed to them so much. In Seneca's political heyday, Stoicism and Epicureanism were battling it out as the two major competing philosophical schools in Rome. But in AD 19, the year Seneca got himself into trouble with his father, there were other offerings besides. About 70 years previously, in around 50 BC, a Roman by the name of Quintus Sextius had founded what is thought to be Rome's first homegrown philosophical school. It is known to history as the School of the Sextii, and its founder had adopted a kind of mix and match approach to what the school's teaching offerings should be. there was definitely a fair bit of Stoicism involved, but there was also a heavy dollop of Pythagoreanism. Now, to the Roman mindset, Pythagoras was a fringe thinker. As far as what your average Roman of the early empire was prepared to accept, he was pretty much out there on the edge. Pythagoras and or his followers and successors believed, among other things, in metempsychosis, that is, the transmigration of the soul at death into another human or creature, and they also believed that the universe was explainable in terms of mathematics. In addition, they preached a form of vegetarianism, which, as well as recommended an abstinence from meat, also warned against certain other foods. A favourite surviving fragment of mine from Pythagoras goes, "Wretches, utter wretches, keep your hands from beans." What's that all about then? It was non-mainstream thinking like this that saw the school ultimately close down, most likely at the same time as all the other supposedly weird and dangerous cults in AD 19. Seneca's problem was that he was strangely attracted to the school of the Sextii, or at least to some of its adherents. Sotion, a Stoic philosopher who seems to have been one of Seneca's actual teachers, was a known affiliate of the school, as was Papirius Fabianus, a high-profile declaimer and philosopher known to both Seneca and his father. Toward the end of his life, the younger Seneca was still writing favourably about both Fabianus and Sotion. So, it was AD 19, and Tiberius was getting worried about the number of weirdos in Rome and their potential threat to established Roman practice, and through that, political stability. Seneca, still at this time in his late teens, had, by his own admission, been influenced by Sotion and become a vegetarian. Whether he was persuaded by the wider Pythagorean outlook is difficult to ascertain, but the choice may have been taken for health reasons. I mentioned in an earlier podcast that Seneca was a sickly child. He suffered frequent bouts of what sounds like some kind of pulmonary-related disease, possibly severe asthma, possibly even a type of pleurisy. The illness was to plague him throughout his life, and he was continually trying different methods, exercise and diet, to mitigate the severity of the attacks. Whatever prompted Seneca to become a veggie, he managed it for at least a year. He later commented that he found the experience pleasant and that it seemed to help him think more clearly. But Seneca's father was having none of it. In AD 19, non-state endorsed practices were being rooted out and penalised, and the elder Seneca feared that vegetarianism would be enough to associate his son with one of the targeted cults and told him to ditch the habit immediately. Seneca claims that he didn't need too much persuading to, as he put it, dine more comfortably, and did what his father wanted. It's actually interesting that Seneca would later put a spin on the episode by making it sound like his father was not so much motivated by a fear of prosecution by the state as his hatred for his son associating with a bunch of philosophers, a discipline which, apparently, the elder Seneca absolutely detested. But that doesn't ring altogether true. The younger Seneca also tries to infer, in those same later writings, that he was influenced into vegetarianism and other habits by his teachers at the time, insinuating that they took the opportunity to impress their own ideals and beliefs on vulnerable young minds. He says that his teachers taught him how to debate, not how to live, and that pupils went to teachers to improve their wits and not their souls. Again, there's a problem here because in those later writings, Seneca is actually bemoaning the demise of philosophy as a discipline, and there's a very good reason for his doing so at that later stage of life, which I will get to in a later podcast. No, the issue in AD 19 was, to my mind, pretty clear-cut. Seneca had an inquiring mind and was drawn to the outre teachings of the school of the Sextii. He was still probably no more than 18 or 19 years old and may have been persuaded that going veggie held some health benefit that would alleviate his persistent respiratory problem. And in addition, who among us doesn't like the idea of reincarnation? But his father was an old hand in Rome. He'd lived through some of the civil wars that had seen the fall of the Republic. He knew that Rome could be perilous for the politically naive, and he didn't want his smart but impressionable middle son involved in anything at all that was going to threaten either the family name or his son's own future political prospects. I think we'll leave young Seneca there for now. Augustus is dead, Tiberius is on the throne, and things are about to get a hell of a lot worse. Hopefully, the young Seneca has learned a valuable lesson from AD 19, but that remains to be seen. So hopefully, I'll see you in the next podcast, which is coming very shortly.